You're listening to an audio recording of the meeting concerning the proposed salmon farm. It was held Wednesday, May 9th at the Hutchinson Center. This is part three.
My name is Debbie Smith. I live in Belfast. And I've observed at least one well in the upper reservoir. I'm wondering if you can explain the purpose of those wells and if you have plans to use the upper reservoir. Thank you.
We did, in fact, install a couple of wells up in the upper reservoir, and part of that was just to get a greater understanding of the watershed as a whole. Obviously, as Mike explained earlier, it's a large area, and the more information we have, the better we're able to make assumptions about how it's going to behave and predict how it might behave in the future if we do withdrawals. There is no plan to use wells in the upper reservoir. Those wells will ultimately be removed so that the folks walking the path up there won't see them along the side of the path. But we don't have any plans at the moment to be developing that as a water source.
Hello, I'm Brendan Brown of Montville. I gotta say, I'm not super clear on the graphs with the filtered discharge and unfiltered discharge. It wasn't obvious to me what process you're talking about, and if it's the same byproducts that you're talking about that are nutrient rich and there's a marketplace for that. Based on what you said, you wanted to differentiate your brand by getting this lower number, which indicates that you're taking a loss by doing the extra filtering despite the fact that you sell the byproduct. I just wish that, would you elaborate a little bit on what those graphs are telling us?
I can try.
Thank you.
So if you look at the history of this industry, 100% is discharged of all nutrients, feed, feces. Copper treatment of sea cages, everything is discharged into the ocean. That's the history of this industry. And that's the point is, like I was trying to say, is that in this case scenario, for a land-based producer, you can pretty much influence and decide what you want to let into your facility and what you want to let out of your facility. So in the case of the discharge here, the starting point is really the same discharge as a C-pen. That's the left-hand column you saw. That's what we would be discharging if we weren't doing any interventions. If you look in Europe right now, regulation regarding discharge is becoming stricter and stricter. And that means the industry needs to respond to this. And it's typically phosphorus is perhaps the most important focus area due to its potential effects for algae growth if you have large releases in areas. So these technologies that we are applying here is not something invented by us. So in the solids, for example, suspended solids, it's what's called drum filters, belt filters that take out all the suspended solids of the water as the water passes through and are gathered up into basically a residual water product that has 1 to 2% dry matter, which will be that sludge. And the next step is to dewater it into more powdery form. So that's taking directly out of your discharge, while the remaining water, where this is removed, will be your discharge. So the little residual you have of suspended solids are the very, very, very fine particular matter that these filters cannot capture. And that's the remaining 1%. So in terms of, and there's a different treatment process for every one of these things. So for example, for phosphorus, it's a two-step process where you basically do also a treatment with so-called aluminate. There's a number of different ways of doing this. It's being applied by many U.S. companies to remove phosphorus from the discharge because there's many, many things that produce phosphorus today. Anything from your toothpaste to your to detergent, it's everywhere. So these technologies are known and they're applied, and it's just a matter of complying with any law that is in the country or region you are in. And beyond that, it's up to the producer to decide if they want to do more. And there is a cost to that, but there's also a benefit to be had in terms of a sustainability profile and brand. My personal clear opinion is that sustainable, socially responsible companies in the future will be the winners in the food industry, and we want to be one of them. So that's just some examples. I don't know if you had further questions, but...
So we have one question. Perfect.
Yeah, I'd be happy to talk to you after the meeting. Yeah.
Hi, Aaron Huber, Friends of Penobscot Bay. I live in Rockland. And I had sort of a double question. One is, there was a mention of salinity in the lower well near the shore. Was that something that occurred during the drilling, during the test pumping? In other words, was saltwater intruding in, or was it already intruded in?
I'll try and answer that. So we didn't actually get to salt water. So we drilled, and there's a certain amount of variability in salinity as you measure, even in what would be ordinarily thought of as a purely freshwater well. You are going to have some variability in your measurements. We did not, even after 3 days of pumping, enter into what we would consider to be a brackish or saline well. I think what Mike's graph was really just showing you is that there is a tidal cycle that we were observing while pumping that well in terms of the pattern. And, you know, if we would consider a saltwater environment to be, I think it would be, what, 32-ish, we were maybe at 4. So less than 1? Yeah, okay. So we were not even close to being in anything that we would consider a salt environment.
I'm Jerry Brown. I live here in Belfast, and I've got a geek question for you. If you think about salmon as a protein conversion system, how many pounds of saleable fish do you get for each pound of feed, or the reverse? What's the range in that?
So the conversion ratio, just to explain that, for salmon is approximately 1 pound of feed for 1 pound of fish. Now, if you want to convert that to a gutted fish, you take out 20%. So if you go to beef or other products, that ratio is completely different. You lose a lot more biomass. So it's widely recognized as the most efficient feed conversion animal to farm in the world today. That's the benefit of fish. And that's why also the international environmental authorities are pointing to fish as perhaps the most important species to be farming in the future due to its sustainability. But that also involves that the industry as a whole needs to be working more and more with sustainability standards in terms of all the things we discussed today. We think we are addressing a lot of them, and there's still more exciting stuff to be happening here. So, but that's the answer to your question.
Yeah. I'm Shelley Swanson-Fine from Northport, and want to also thank you for this presentation. My questions have to do with the added value to the Belfast area. I'm assuming you're going to look to hire local people. And also, we have a salmon processing plant here. They have to import their salmon to process. Is there any chance you can hook up with our salmon processing plant?
Well, to answer your question, we were there today and met with the plant manager. So you had a couple of questions. We are starting our early employment in the U.S. perspective. We happen to be starting here in Maine. So my hope is that we will find a good lot of employees from the local area if they want to work for us. We will also be importing employees because some of these positions we're talking about requires a long experience, and we hope to be also recruiting college graduates from Maine. There are a number of programs that are relevant to what we're doing. So we are hoping for a nice bouquet of local employees, U.S. national employees, and maybe a few international ones also. If you look at our operations in Norway, it's also international. We brought an employee from British Columbia to Norway. So I hope and think that that will form the basis for, you know, a bustling, exciting aquaculture community here in Belfast and the region, right? So in terms of duck trap, which I'm assuming you were referring to, we had a very nice meeting there today with the plant manager and the CEO over there. They seemed to be interested in local supply, and we did discuss many of the benefits of the product. We did discuss it in the context of a number of the customers they have and the potential benefits. I don't feel I can go into detail about what they said, but they happen to be a Norwegian-owned company as well, in case you didn't know this. So I felt we hit it off at a very good tone, and it's something we will follow up in the future and see where that can lead us. We will be positive to finding cooperation with them. Yeah.
I'm Sid Quarrier. I live in Appleton. Since seawater is an important part of this, the Gulf of Maine is not a static joint these days. It's going through profound changes, and both the magnitude and trajectory of those changes are really not clearly understood. And with that change are changes to the plankton of all sorts in the bay. So my question is, as the future issues around plankton are simply unclear, is the plankton filtered out of, and what parts of the plankton are filtered out of your system, and can changes in plankton or even toxins or die-offs affect what you have to discharge or how you run your plant?
Okay. That's a broad topic. Just to make clear, we don't use toxins in the facility. So there's no discharge of any toxin. And that relates also to the chemicals and medication side, like I touched on. So in terms of, to be honest, I don't know the whole plankton community, you might say, in the bay. And I don't know what potential issues. What we are concerned about is a lot of the things that are happening in the ocean, like you're mentioning. And we are following very closely developments that may be happening along the coastline here in terms of oxygen depletion, plastic, microplastic problems, climate change, many of the issues. As far as our discharge in this case, or the intake, it's an insignificant amount of water compared to what's in the bay. So it's inconceivable for me to think that it would have any impact whatsoever. And the other piece of that is also that, you know, if there are discussions, issues going on in the community about ocean conditions, anything we can get engaged in, we'd be happy to do that, just so you know that.
My name is David Tannhauser. I live in Waldo. When you said there are no antibiotics routinely used, does that include antifungals also?
Fungus?
Antifungals, right?
No. So what we've seen generally is there are a couple of producers working with freshwater, also for grout operations. What we've seen there in many cases is that you can get more fungal problems, but we're not doing that. So typically the treatment for fungal will be salt. So those who are producing with freshwater, they have applied salt to treat fungal problems. So there's no medication involved in that should you get that.
Yeah, some of my question relates to, my name is Jim Merkel. I live here in Belfast, and some of my questions relate to process, but also to, like, trustability and sustainability. I teach sustainability, and I've written books about it. I study life cycle analysis, and when you put up a number of one-third the energy of shipped salmon, I need to know, is that a full life cycle analysis, including glass, steel, inputs, outputs, and also things that are hard to quantify, but also I want to know how we can trust sustainability. For example, my son and I went to walk the site, and we just were curious. So we had out our GPS, and we came across this really mucked up area that led us all the way to the test drill. And I have cut the trees from my own land to build a house, but you never go on land with any machine unless it's frozen or it's stable. That's just, it's in the main, you know, it's just common sense, and it's also in the law. But we came across the creek that had logs piled in the creek to allow you to cross it with the machinery. So I want to know, and then we found all this sediment in the creek. But then my son and I went to look where the creek hadn't been disturbed. These are the little, along the Little River Trail, and you can see the creek is a beautiful little creek compared to your creek near your, where you breached it, completely choked with sediment. And, you know, we're just wondering sustainability. I want to know, like, okay, you didn't involve us in the process. You can't, you know, two info sessions without real good public comment. We had a public session with the city, overwhelming opposition. And the next day in the paper, it's like, oh, there was no problem. We got our next green stamp is on your website. And I'm sitting here, I teach this stuff for 30 years. I'm not a newcomer to sustainability. I've never found a sustainable monoculture in my life. And, you know, I teach this stuff. We teach caged. We won't feed my family caged. It's torture fish to me. This is torture, you know. But it's like that's an ethical component. Around the college campuses, we're talking cage-free, humane treatment, fair wages, all these things. And we were talking bring back our fisheries, have local, organic. All these things are missing here. Like everything I teach at the university in sustainability is missing. And I want to hear how you paint this as sustainability when it's completely opposite what I've been teaching for 30 years. I need to know.
You want to comment the first part?
I'll comment on the first part, and then I'll let Eric take it from there. So this winter, as many of you know, wasn't typical. We had a pretty good thaw rate in February, which is not typical. And that's right when a number of the investigations were going on. That's why we invited Maine DEP out to the site to look at what we were doing for sediment control. But I'll also point out that we were primarily traveling on existing wood roads. So that log bridge you were referring to, that's been there for before our time on site. A number of the a good chunk of the property had a series of existing logging roads, and we tried as best we could to use those for a number of reasons, but also to help minimize that impact. And yes, this was a freeze-thaw cycle, and there was mud. But I think those of you who walk the trails will find that there's already been an effort to reseed and hay areas that were disturbed. If you go up along the upper reservoir, for example, you can see where the water district has already, laid out hay to help things reseed. And we've done a pretty sizable job to try to make sure that the impacts are temporary and are mitigated. I'll let Eric speak maybe some more to the overall question of sustainability.
Okay.
Jim, we're asking for an environment of mutual respect and civility, okay. And really what the protocol is for today is one question per person.
Okay.
So thank you, Jim.
Well, I appreciate you showing us. So, I mean, we appreciate getting feedback on these things. So, obviously, there are many things happening, and my understanding is DEP was involved and so on, but in terms of sustainability, I think it's really a matter of where you're coming from. What we're doing is widely recognized as one of the most sustainable ways of producing fish and volume today by many, many environmental organizations. But it depends on where you're coming from and what your alternative is. So I don't know if I can take the discussion any further than that at this point, but I'd be happy to speak to you afterwards, you know, if we can have a discussion about it.
About the one-third number.
And one-third what? Yes, okay. So this is scientifically documented between SINTEF in Norway, research institution, and the Freshwater Institute in the U.S., a cooperation project where they're taking all the different CO2 components from construction, concrete, everything, put the, and operations and shipment, and put it together in an equation showing the CO2 component of a fish to market. And they're not taking into account, for example, what's your source of energy? Is it coal or is it renewable energies? And they're taking all these dimensions into account. And based upon that, they have estimated the CO2 output to the end customer, for example, for a land-based product based upon renewable, more green energy sources versus coal-powered. And then they've taken a CPEN product coming from Norway to the U.S., air freighted fresh, and compared that. So air freighted fresh to the U.S. from, for example, Norway is 15 kilos equivalent CO2. A land-based product in the U.S., built in a land-based farm, is approximately 5. There can be variations from product to project to project, depending on how you construct it, your local energy supply, many things like that. But it's, you can look it up. The Whitewater Institute in Freshwater Institute in the U.S. has been involved in the study.
So I would just, before you speak, I'd like to remind everyone that we are hoping for one question per person. This is not a time for personal testimony. There will be additional hearings in the future for public comment. And so in an environment of mutual respect and civility, we ask for one question per person.
Hi, I'm Rhonda Feynman. I live in Belfast. And I want to go back to the discharge into the bay because I'm not clear about it. I do appreciate the charts, and I'm glad that you're going to go the extra level and the extra mile to create less sludge. But I'm still not clear about what the impact of that sludge discharge will be on our bay. I'm not an oceanographer. I don't know offhand what the tides are and how the currents work. I don't know where that's going. Is it going to go back to Norway? Is it going to London? Sure. Is it going to Rockland? Is it and so is it going to change the temperature? Is it going to sit on the bottom of our bay and change that whole ecosystem in ways we don't know? So that's the question I have.
Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, we are not discharging the sludge. Okay? So, again, this is captured, dewatered, and it's a waste resource that has a value. So it's a very, very small amount that's not filtered out. And if you compare it to the agricultural runoff and everything else going into bay, it's like a needle in a haystack. We looked at the other permits in the area as well that's been given for environmental permits. I don't know if you do you have any perspective on that?
I can say a little bit. So first of all, you do raise obviously an interesting point about where does it go. The Belfast Bay is a complex bay system, and although there are a number of studies that have been done modeling and measuring the currents in the bay, there's nothing that's yet specific to right in the area where this discharge pipe would ultimately go. So part of that is a question that we hope to continue to research ourselves in terms of understanding where do we need to put that endpoint to minimize the impact and maximize the dispersion of what water does come down that pipe. And so we'll be taking additional measurements and doing additional current modeling to study the exact point of where this pipe will go. So hopefully in a future meeting we'll have additional information to provide for you. But I think one of the things that is just to put it in context for people is I think Eric had showed you earlier the graph of phosphorus, and there's this big, tall, here's what it could be, and here's what we're taking it down to. That what he takes it down to, that 6 pounds of phosphorus per day, is the same as about 10 to 15 lawns in the neighborhood and what that discharges from the grass. And that's not even somebody who's using a lot of fertilizer. That's just simply what's coming off of grass through rainwater. So thinking in terms of that, it is really a small number that ultimately is going out into the bay itself. And I hope that helps.
My name is Mary Bigelow. I'm from Belfast. I have a fairly narrow question. If you're raising your fish in salt water, isn't the manure saline? And how can you make a salt-free product from salty manure?
Are you thinking about the sludge? Right. Okay. So typically, it depends on the purpose we finally end up applying that to. So there are a number of different directions we can take with a sludge resource. So in Norway, there's a number of different directions also the industry is using, depending on the location, what the market is. If you're looking for a soil enhancement product, you will typically mix it up with other biological materials. So it will be so that's obviously this is something we're starting a study on in Maine to understand the various market opportunities in Maine for a type of end product or process that will be optimal for Maine. And there are a number of different directions we can take. So I hope not too far into this year that we will have some more specific directions that we can point to with the partner that we're going to be working with this on. So it's an exciting area that I hope can, you know, return some value back to some industry sector in this state. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Leslie Miller from Belfast, and I'm glad to hear that you're talking to Duck Trap. But I find myself on Route 1 many times a week. And it's a horror story. And you have all these trucks coming in, and you have all these trucks going out. And has anybody thought that it's going to create a complete impossibility?
I'll try and answer that a little bit. So as you know, we have a long road ahead of us in the permitting process. There are town permits that we need to go through, as well as state permits that we need to go through. And one of those larger permitting things ahead of us is to evaluate impacts to the overall community, so things like noise, things like traffic. And so obviously the first thing we start with is studying the existing traffic patterns and looking at what is going up and down Route 1, what's coming in and out of side streets, what does it look like to try and merge onto Route 1, and then looking at what are the truck traffic trips that would be coming in and out of the facility. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Eric, that's 10... about a dozen trips per day. And then the impact, obviously, of employees coming in and out of the facility. So in the process of doing that, you develop a sound plan for how you're going to get the traffic from the facility to be a minimal impact on what's already there. I can't do much about summer traffic coming up Route 1, but we can hope to minimize the additional impact that we have from the facility.
Hi, my name is Lawrence Reichert. I'm a resident of Belfast. And Mr. Himes said that there would be no escapage from the facility. And just for the benefit of the public here, the reason that's important is that the land-based fish will be less hardy than the open water fish. And they will then breed, if they are able to escape, they will breed with the open water fish. And that will make the offspring less hardy. It's also important because they compete with the open water fish for spawning grounds, and they destroy the spawning grounds of open water fish. Now, Mr. Heim said earlier that there would be zero escapage from this, but I spoke with a Dr. Anders Carlson Drangsholt of the Bellon Foundation in Norway, and he said that no matter how secure anyone thinks their facility is, there is a known problem of fish escapage from indoor facilities. Double barriers can't prevent this altogether, especially because there are tears in the water outlet filters that especially fish in their younger stages when they're smaller can escape through. Can you please comment on that?
Sure. So do you have barriers inside the actual production models? A number of barriers, screen barriers. And then the water goes out to external final treatment, discharge treatment. So in essence, to have an escape, you would have the fish swimming through about six, seven physical barriers, which all would have to fail at the same time. So what I can say is you can probably come up with a theoretical case where it can happen, but what we can say for sure is that the risk is tremendously reduced compared to a CPIM production. That's what I can say to you.
My name is Alicia Gallero. I'm a resident of Belfast. I'm also a college student at the University of Maine Farmington. I actually wanted to directly reference the life cycle analysis that you described, paper. So I would like to have you speak to the economic viability of this project, because in that paper it's cited that a comparative analysis of the recirculating aquaculture systems to Net Pen Farms, and it found that the capital costs are 80% higher for recirculating aquaculture systems and that the production costs are 10% higher. And then the most significant finding of this, and these are of farms in equal in size or equal in scale, that open net pen farms see twice the return on investment, even when the recirculating aquaculture system salmon is sold at a 30% price premium to that of the net pen produced salmon. Obviously, I'm not against this project in any way, sure, personally, in terms of the environmental impact, but I just am curious about the long-term viability and sustainability in order to be competitive in the market.
Sure. So there's several questions in terms of investment cost. When you look at the cost of getting permits and setting up a CPEN operation today, if you wanted to buy one CPEN permit, the total cost of that is higher than an equal production amount to build a land-based facility today, if you do it right in the right location. Historically, the challenge has been facilities have been small. So, and that's why you're seeing bigger and bigger facilities, because there's a certain scale advantage you need to get to be capital efficient. So as of today, the investment community in Norway and us is also being more and more seen in the U.S. is that they're almost equal in capital efficiency in terms of investment levels. It's changed a lot in recent years. It's a very rapid development. In terms of production cost, again, if you are at the right location, executing your business and your production properly, you are seeing cost parity in production costs more or less today. And part of the reason for that is that CPEN production costs have more than doubled in the last 7-8 years. So it's a very different picture just a few years ago. So it's a rapid development. So, and this is why you were seeing a lot of capital moving around this now, because suddenly capital cost is in the same range, production cost in the same range. So in our case, we're not assuming a large premium in the long term, because to be viable, it has to be competitive. And in the end, it's a matter of limitations in number of CPEN locations, and that means that to be able to increase global supply, you have to think in new ways. And this is one of the avenues that is attracting a lot of interest right now, because they're seeing it in dozens and dozens of farms in Norway, smolt and post-smolt, land-based farms, and also a number of farms in Europe now that production is viable. But you're right. If you have a small farm, you're going to struggle with financial viability. You need scale. So I hope that partly answers your question. But isn't it many? I probably have 10, 15 students proposing a study every month comparing CPEN and land-based farming. It's a very, very popular topic, for sure. Yeah.
So it's 7:37, so we'll take two more questions. Okay. So we'll have two more questions. So and then I know there are more questions that people have, and staff will be available for a few minutes after, and they can also be contacted from Nordic Aquafarms, from Ransom Consulting. And then, as always, you can connect with myself or city councilors by email or by phone or by coming to a meeting.
I'm Marta Frisardi. I don't live in Belfast. I live in Thomaston. But I came up here because I read the article in the Free Press. And I want to know more about the jobs that the plant will be offering, because I would like to know if you would be willing to partner with the University of Maine and perhaps tell us what types of skills you would like those students to have. As someone who teaches genetics and microbiology, I'd like to know, because I'm ready if you are.
Thank you. Well, I can tell you that we have a great partnership with the Norwegian University of Life Sciences, which happens to be just 30 minutes away from our Norwegian site. One of the they have had multiple interests. One of them is, of course, research. So we have a fairly large environmental grant in Norway, which they are part of. But the other part they've been interested in is recruitment of students to marine sciences. And they realized that these kinds of projects does attract a lot of interest, student interest. So in terms of Maine, we would love to be in contact. We've had some contacts here and there, but we haven't really engaged yet. There are internship opportunities, obviously recruitment opportunities. We'd love to have the younger generation of Mainers coming from universities, coming to learn the business and be a part of it in the future. So I hope we have a chance to discuss that more. Yeah.
My name's Armin D. McFadden, and I own the aquaculture site just downstream to where you propose to be dumping that water and whatever else is in it. I haven't heard anything today about the nitrogen content in the water, and I'd like to know what you propose to do if an algae bloom starts on my aquaculture site as well as the rest of the bay around here. And are you also aware that 90% of the world's eels come through the Penobscot Bay to spawn here? And there's over 18 species that will be directly impacted. And how often do you plan on checking those traps in your pipe?
Okay. So in terms of nitrogen, we are taking out 60% of that. That leaves it at 1,600 pounds a day, which is well within the permits that have been given in this area before for other businesses. And I think the important thing is that if we are discharging far offshore with a very efficient spreading when we finalize the pinpointing of that. Well, we are looking at probably, to get to the appropriate depth where we want to be, we're probably looking at a mile, plus minus. No, I'm not sure where your site is, but certainly we could have a discussion about that. So if you look at the total nitrogen discharge that probably goes into this bay, this is small in the end. And you will not find any land-based or fish producer taking out more than that we are taking out in this case. So that's the best answer I can give right now.
So I would like to thank you all again for being here tonight. We're going to conclude the question and answer. And as I mentioned, staff will be here for a few minutes after this session. I will still be here, and you can connect with City Council members by email or phone.
You've been listening to a recording of the meeting held Wednesday, May 9th at the Hutchinson Center to discuss the proposed salmon farm. Thanks to Ned Leitner of Community Television for the recording, and thank you for your interest in public affairs here in Belfast.